As Bob Dylan once sang, the times, they are a-changin'. At least, that's what it looks like in Miami-Dade County's political landscape. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. I'm your host, Joshua Ceballos. Tim Padgett is out this week. In the next hour, we'll take a look at the spate of elections that took place throughout South Florida this week and how the political patterns of the past several decades seem to be shifting in some major city governments. We'll talk about the first competitive mayoral election in the city of Miami in more than 20 years. We'll also speak about Hialeah's youngest mayor in the city's 100-year history and what the outlook is for a city facing economic uncertainty. Finally, we'll round up local elections in cities on the coast and to the south from Miami-Dade to Monroe County. All this right after the news. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Joshua Ceballos. Tim Padgett is out this week. I'm so glad you could be here with us. For the past two decades, mayoral elections in the city of Miami have been decided outright on Election Day in November. In the past two cycles, Mayor Francis Suarez won the seat in a series of landslide victories. But this year, the race is going to a runoff in December between two candidates that couldn't be further apart. On the one side, you have Emilio Gonzalez, a Cuban-American candidate who worked in the George W. Bush White House as the Director of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. Now, the city mayor's seat is nonpartisan because Gonzalez has aligned himself with conservative politicians and received an endorsement from Governor Ron DeSantis. Gonzalez also worked for President Donald Trump's campaign and has spoken positively about his immigration policy. On the other side, you have Eileen Higgins, a white non-Hispanic woman aligned with Democrats who's run a campaign on supporting Miami's working class and LGBTQ communities. Higgins has held office on the Miami-Dade County Commission since 2018, representing parts of downtown Miami and Little Havana, leading predominantly Hispanic neighborhoods. She's actually the front runner in this year's mayoral election, pulling ahead of Gonzalez in the general by about 15 percentage points. But now that the two of them are going head-to-head and the other 11 candidates are out of the race, things are about to get more contentious. What do you think about this heated election in Miami-Dade County's largest city? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now in the studio is frontrunner Colonel Emilio T. Gonzalez to talk about his outlook going into the runoff. Emilio, thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, thank you for the invitation, Josh.
So this general election was extremely packed. It was 13 candidates, many of them conservative Cuban Americans like yourself. What does it mean to you that you were able to come out as the front runner among them? Why do you think that you pulled ahead and resonated with voters more than, say, a Joe Carollo or an Alex Diaz de la Portilla?
Well, I think it has to be the agenda for change. If you look at all the candidates, the top three candidates were candidates that were talking about change, about a new direction, new faces, new names. And the people that did the least or did the worst were the old guard, the old last names, if you will, the political dynasties. I don't like using that term, but that's exactly what it is. So I think people were tired. You know, I campaigned throughout the city, and I kept hearing over and over again that people were tired. They were fed up. Many people used the word that I used at one time, the circus, every other week in City Hall. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably what propelled the three of us, if you will, and now the two of us, to where we are today.
That's right. I mean, we've talked a lot on this show about the Miami mess, which is a frequent refrain. And it does seem that way, that the frontrunners really talked about bringing order to the dysfunction in City Hall.
You know, I remember as city manager, I used to travel regularly to Tallahassee, always, you know, shaking the money tree, bringing money home. And I one time remember a state legislature that pulled me aside and said, "Hey, you guys are the best entertainment in Tallahassee, because every 2 weeks we stop what we're doing and we tune in." Man, that was embarrassing. It really was. And you hear stories like that compounded, if you will, by this summer when we had the whole election debacle.
We'll get into all of that a little later in the show. I wanted to ask, what does it mean to you that your opponent, Eileen Higgins, who you said you have friendly relationships with, is a Democrat and non-Hispanic woman, and that she came ahead of you in this race and got the first place spot on election night? What does that tell you, and how do you plan to address that in the runoff?
Well, listen, it really doesn't bother me, because when you break down all the candidates, if you will, Eileen Higgins was really only competing against Ken Russell. You know, she advertised herself as being, I believe the term was, a trusted Democrat. She campaigned as a Democrat. She got endorsements as a Democrat. And I did not. You know, I had to compete against 12 other people. So she campaigned against one. I campaigned against 12. And I think that now that it's down to me and her, you know, things are going to start falling in the line. I think this is going to be a very tight race. I don't think, quite honestly, that this is going to be a blowout. Mm. But I do think that it's gotten unnecessarily partisan, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So I want to go back and talk a little bit about your CV. Like you mentioned earlier, this is not your first foray into City of Miami government. You were previously the city manager from 2017 to 2020. You left office for a few reasons, in part due to family issues at home, if I'm not mistaken, but also due to some dysfunction in the city government. You actually testified in federal court against Commissioner Joe Carollo, and you testified that he took you around to properties in Little Havana owned by his rivals, wanted you to look into code violations, and then the city attorney at that time, you know, had a list of properties for you to look at. A lot of drama. And that was sort of the air around City Hall when you left. Why come back? Why step back into that dysfunction?
Because, you know, as city manager, yes, you are the chief administrative officer of the city, but you really don't have any power to affect change. You do what the elected officials dictate that needs to be done. And as a resident of the city, and having been a victim, I'll be honest, having been a victim of this weaponization of government, if you will, I kept getting encouraged by my colleagues, my neighbors, my friends. Hey, look, as time goes by, Mayor Suarez is termed out. You ought to look at this. Nobody knows a city like you. And I just thought long and hard about it. And then finally in April the 9th, I think it was, I just decided to go ahead and file with a great deal of support.
And I wanted to talk about your vision for Miami as mayor. Now, the City of Miami mayor position is a weak mayor position. So that means the mayor does not have a vote on the city commission, does not have the power to legislate. They do have veto power and the ability to choose a city manager. What is your idea for what you want to do as mayor if you were to win?
I need to disagree with you. It isn't so much a weak mayor. It's that the mayor may not vote, but he does have the ultimate vote, which is a veto. Mm-hmm. But the mayor can influence. Mm-hmm. Okay. And I think the mayor's position as it stands right now, I am not in favor of a strong mayor, just so you know right now. I like the balance of power, if you will. But, you know, the mayor has three basic powers. He appoints the city manager, the mayor has veto authority, and the mayor also sits as a chairman of the commission, something that no other mayor has done, but which I plan to do. I am going to be the chairman of the commission, which is in and of itself a very powerful position. When it comes down to what we want to do, I've been very clear. I've issued some very, very detailed policy statements because I break this down into three areas, Josh. It's governability, right? Honest, fair, decent government. The mayor is also the titular head of the city. The mayor represents us everywhere, locally, nationally, internationally. So you want a person that's well-rounded. You want a person that has done a myriad of things. You want a person who's led. I've been in a leadership position my entire life to include not only leading the city of Miami, but also the airport, which is the biggest economic engine in the state of Florida, and the U.S. Immigration Service, which when I was there had 19,000 employees. So you want to have that kind of gravitas in leadership. But you have to be honest, open, and sober, right? You have to lead in such a way that people gain your respect. And right now, our leadership, and I'm talking about generic municipal leadership, is not respected by the voters. And we can talk about that later.
So you mentioned your time at USCIS,
yes.
And I think that's important, especially right now with what's going on in this country. I think there's a lot of anger from the electorate about President Donald Trump's immigration policy. Some people are very much in support, but we've seen protests around the country related to the immigration policy. When you were the head of USCIS, CIS extended temporary protected status, or TPS, for Hondurans and Nicaraguans, and President Trump has announced that he would revoke TPS for those groups, has moved to cancel TPS for Venezuelans. A lot of these groups live here in Miami. So what is your stance on immigration and Trump's immigration policy if you were to be the mayor of a city of immigrants?
Well, that's a mouthful. First of all, I used to sign TPS, so it wasn't just under me. I would actually sign and approve TPS. And I think that at some point, probably in the last several years, TPS really lost its meaning. For example, we give El Salvador TPS because of damages that they incurred during Hurricane Mitch. That was, 25 years ago. TPS, by definition, is supposed to be something transitory, something temporary, where foreign nationals from a designated country that are in the United States physically and can't go home, they are given an opportunity to stay here until such time as they can go home. Well, now you have El Salvador, which has actually got one of the strongest economies in Central America. They're attracting billions in foreign direct investment. Honduras is the same way. Nicaragua, much different, but the numbers for TPS in Nicaragua are minimal. And then you have, you know, the issue with Venezuela. I personally think that we'll find a way out of this whole Venezuela TPS thing. But the more important thing is that during the last administration, the United States basically ceased to have borders. And whether your number is 15 million, 12 million, 20 million, an inordinate number of people came across the border for which we had no control of. We had no idea who they were. They could have come across the border. And I've used this example. 15,000 men could cross the border and said to the Border Patrol officer, "My name is Josh Ceballos." And that Border Patrol officer would not be in authority to question them. He would have to accept them because none of them had identification.
So you're in support of a stricter border policy and immigration policy?
I'm in support of a border policy. We did not have a border policy.
Gotcha.
And that's how. And listen, I've lectured on border security and immigration. I still do. I have a lot of colleagues that are still in the service. And essentially, the pendulum went way in one direction. And now the pendulum is swinging in the other direction.
Mm-hmm. Well, Colonel Emilio T. Gonzalez, thank you so much for coming on. Emilio Gonzalez is one of the City Miami mayoral candidates set to be in a runoff this December. Emilio, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Enjoyed being with you.
Thank you. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Joshua Ceballos. We are discussing the results of Miami's mayoral election with the two candidates that are now set to battle it out in a runoff in December. We just spoke with Emilio Gonzalez. I'd now like to turn to the other frontrunner, former County Commissioner Eileen Higgins. Eileen, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, hello, Joshua. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much. And a reminder to our listeners that you can weigh in. If you'd like to talk about the Miami mayoral election, call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So, Eileen, Tuesday night was a big night for you, right?
Yes, it was very exciting. I feel so honored that so many people in the city I love so much selected me to advance to the second round on December 9th.
Yes, and so I would say the results on Tuesday, with you being the very clear first place front runner, was surprising, maybe not for you, but for some observers, because in Miami for the past two decades, the voters have elected a Cuban-American man who is generally conservative. You are a non-Hispanic woman aligned with liberal democratic politics. Why do you feel that you were able to drive this campaign to resonate so much with voters in this race?
Well, I have served a third of the residents in the city of Miami as their county commissioner for just about 8 years. So I bring a real track record of results. Basically, everybody else in the race is associated with the city of Miami, which we all know is quite notorious for chaos, disruption, lack of results, terrible permitting, corruption. And I, for the past 8 years, have served those residents in the city quietly and capably and built thousands of affordable housing units during that time. Led the effort to reform our permitting system at the county so you can permit affordable housing much more quickly. You can permit repairs on your homes more quickly. I've passed a number of really important environmental protections, like the strongest fertilizer bill in the state of Florida, which Nova University is now showing is starting to bring back the oxygenation in the bay. So I just have a track record of results. That's what people want. They want a local government that works for them, not one that is constantly distracted with a bunch of folks just yelling and screaming at each other and always in court. It is not what government should be. And I'm very happy that people recognized me for my work rather than for a lot of yelling and screaming.
Yeah. So you mentioned you spent the better part of the last 7 or 8 years as commissioner in Miami-Dade County. Now, the county has a much wider local reach, and you might say it has more direct power. A county commissioner as a legislator versus Miami, where the mayor does not have a vote. What made you make this decision to run for city mayor and relinquish your position on the county commission because you still had a few years there?
I just listened to everything on WLRN and watched the news and watched the city I live in and the city I love accomplish nothing over the past 8 years. I did not make the decision lightly. In order to get on the ballot before I gave up my seat on the commission, I went door to door and I knocked on thousands of doors to ask people's permission to be on the ballot. I was the only candidate that qualified by petition. Over 3,000 people said, yes, we would like you to represent us at mayor. And so that gave me the confidence that they were okay and that they needed a responsible, functioning person that just goes to work every day on their behalf in the city of Miami. And that's what I've done since 2018 when I've been elected.
And during your time on the county commission, you've prioritized issues with when it comes to the environment and public transportation, whether that be with the Better Bus Network or Metro Rail or Metro Mover expansion. What's your vision for the city of Miami when it comes to leading on those particular issues?
So importantly, my top priority has always been affordable housing. And right now in the city of Miami, if I submitted a project to get permitted to build, let's say, 100 units of affordable housing, it could take over 2 years to get the permits. That is 2 years people are locked out of homes they can afford. So permitting has to be fixed. By the way, that is why so many of their resiliency projects are behind, whether it's your street that's flooding or a stormwater pump that should have been installed. When it takes 2 to 3 years to permit your own resiliency projects, not only are we not being resilient, those projects over a couple year period of time can increase in cost by more than 40%. It's wasteful. We need to get to the city. We need to look at all these broken processes, fix them, just the like I did at the county, because affordability and resiliency are two of the most important issues facing every single person that lives in the city of Miami.
One of the big fights that's been going on in the past few years between the city and the county has been around RTZ, rapid transit zones. The county has a law that designates certain areas along transit corridors as rapid transit zones, corridors like Metro Rail and bus rapid transit. And developers are allowed to build high-density housing along those corridors to promote transit-oriented development. This is supposed to supersede and preempt local zoning authority, and the city of Miami has been very against that. There have been multiple meetings between the city and the county arguing because the city wants their own zoning authority and believes that RTZ is dangerous. So if you were to become the leader of the city now on the other side of the argument, how do you see that shaking out? Would you try and lead the city in the direction of following in line with the county?
So, every single household in our community faces the top two expenses. Expense number one is housing, expense number two is transportation. Matter of fact, nationally, they have an index for it. It's called the T plus H index. No one is supposed to spend more than 40% of their income on housing and transportation. And in our community, we can be upwards of 60%. That's why people can't make ends meet. That's the reason I think housing and transportation have got to be linked. We have got to have affordable and workforce housing located near reliable public transportation. That's been a priority of mine in the county, and it will be a priority of mine at the city. Now, there's a lot of other upscaling that makes me very nervous as the incoming mayor for the city. And that is the Live Local law that the state passed, because essentially that law allows you to upzone almost everything a mile away from the next tallest building. And we are seeing intense applications, particularly up on 36th Street, but some in the Grove. I represent the Rhodes now. It's a single family neighborhood, but that's less than a mile from Brickell. That is the thing that worries me the most, because we could end up with outrageous density in neighborhoods where it's completely inappropriate and it's not located anywhere near transit.
Gotcha. Now, in the few seconds we have left, you've made it a big priority in your campaign to show support for the LGBTQ community. And the state, meanwhile, has attacked things like rainbow crosswalks or cities, putting up a rainbow flag. How do you intend to face against the state, or do you intend to face against the state and their policies with regards to LGBTQ?
What I tell every resident in the city of Miami when I talk to them at their doors is I thank them for living here, working here, raising their family here, being part of our community. And I support all of them. We are living in a world where from Washington and from Tallahassee, there is this culture of trickle-down hatred. We have governments that are building cages for people rather than building housing for people.
Yep.
I want to be a mayor that speaks up for every single resident that lives here. If you're a disabled person and you can't get across the street, if you are a member of the LGBTQ community and you're feeling nervous, it doesn't matter who you are. You live here. You're part of Miami. I will be your mayor.
And that's a good place to end it. Thank you so much, Eileen, for coming on and speaking with us. We've been speaking with Eileen Higgins, one of the front runners going into the runoff for Miami's mayoral election in December. Thank you, Eileen.
Thank you very much.
Still to come on the roundup, Hialeah has elected its youngest mayor. Could it signal a new day for the city? This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Joshua Ceballos. We're chugging along with our roundup of South Florida elections with Miami-Dade County's second biggest city, Hialeah. The city just elected its youngest mayor ever, 27-year-old Harvard graduate Brian Calvo. Calvo won a landslide victory Tuesday night, overcoming his frontrunner opponents Jesus Tundidor and interim mayor Jackie Garcia-Robes by 30 percentage points, close to 5,000 votes. Calvo's victory might mark a shift away from the old guard of Hialeah. Garcia-Robes was the hand-picked candidate of former Mayor Esteban Bobo, who held two terms in office before he stepped down to take a lobbying job in Washington, D.C. When Calvo was on the Hialeah City Council, he made a habit of fighting back against Bobo's policies. He was the sole no vote when the rest of the council sided with the mayor. He also pushed for an investigation into the city's 911 dispatch centers when it was found that thousands of 911 calls in Hialeah went unanswered. Do you live in Hialeah? What would you like to see out of a new, younger administration? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Mayor Calvo had planned to join us today but had a minor medical emergency and couldn't make it. So joining me today is local writer and political watchdog Elaine De Valle of the blog Political Cortadito. Elaine, it's such a pleasure to have you on.
It's so great to be on with you, Joshua.
Yes.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. I'm happy to hear your voice. So, Elaine, Tuesday night was a historic moment for the city of Hialeah. Brian Calvo, youngest elected mayor in the city's century of history. What were your thoughts when you saw those results come in?
Honestly, I was a little stunned by the margin. A 30-point landslide is rare in Hialeah, especially when you're going up against the so-called machine. But it was also refreshing because you could feel this groundswell building, this appetite for change, and he does capture all of that. The voters weren't just choosing a 27-year-old. They were rejecting the same old insiders who've treated City Hall like their clubhouse for decades. And speaking of that, I mean, I did speak to Calvo earlier today by phone. He has not heard yet from the interim mayor. She hasn't called to concede, let alone to start the transition process. His swearing in is in January, but he has, you know, he's basically a mayor without a city right now because he hasn't been able to communicate with the current administration in order to provide for a transition.
Isn't that something? In your time watching local politics in Miami-Dade for Politico Cortadito and the Miami Herald formerly, how would you describe Hialeah's politics over the years?
Hialeah's politics have always been a mix of loyalty and survival. It's been dominated historically by strong-arm mayors and political patronage. Basically, if you work for the city or your primo work for the city, you voted for whoever the boss told you to vote for. It's been a colorful place, and there's been a lot of personality and a long history of vote by bus operations and absentee ballot shenanigans. I mean, if you remember the 2012 elections, there were several arrests in Hialeah for people who were, basically collecting absentee ballots for some candidates. But beneath that, it is a working class community, and they just want a fair shot, clean water, clean streets, and responsive services. And I think that Brian Calvo's messaging resonated with them.
Yeah, he made a reputation for himself as sort of a renegade on the council when he was a council member not too long ago against the administration of Mayor Bovo, who very much fit the mold of a classic Hialeah mayor. Do you think that sort of renegade status is going to translate into a Calvo term as mayor?
It depends on how much the old system Calvo can actually dismantle. It's one thing to run as the outsider fighting the establishment, but now he is the establishment. He's going to have to prove that he can govern with transparency, accountability, which is what he, campaigned on, without falling into the same habits. He's young. And he's educated. That can help him modernize City Hall, which is very necessary in Hialeah. But the City of Progress has a way of chewing up reformers, and it's gonna be a rough go of it, especially if he's not welcomed through the transition period. His voting history, it shows he's independent, and made him popular with the people who were tired of the rubber stamp Seguro Que Yes Council. But now his challenge is flipping from being the critic to being the leader who can actually build consensus. We'll have to watch to see if he can bring that backbone that he has had to managing allies and rivals. And that also depends on who he surrounds himself, whether it will be professionals, which I think and hope that's what he's going to lean into, rather than the political loyalists that have been the stories of the past. That's going to be the real test, who he brings on board. There'll be some changes for sure.
For sure. And you mentioned this a little earlier, but after the election, you wrote a piece with the headline that I really enjoyed. Brian Calvo breaks the Hialeah machine, wins mayor race outright. What is this machine? Why do you feel like he broke the machine?
Well, he broke the establishment machinery in the sense that the Bovo Garcia Robles machine had all the usual ingredients, the name recognition, the party backing, developers, city employees, money, endorsements from past mayors and a lot of important people, the Whisper Network. But Calvo was able to beat it and cleanly without a runoff. That's unheard of. And now he doesn't owe that victory to any power broker. In Hialeah, that's like breaking the sound barrier. That's just crazy. It means that voters, have finally said enough, and I think it's a new day. And that's why I said he broke the Hialeah machine. I mean, if he can, this can be the new way of running campaigns and winning in Hialeah.
Yeah, times are changing. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Joshua Ceballos. I'm speaking with political writer Elaine DeValle about the city of Hialeah's election and the change in guard at City Hall. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. And a reminder that if you miss any part of the program, you can search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. Elaine, continuing our conversation on Hialeah and its new mayor, Brian Calvo, you've reported on some of the controversies surrounding Calvo and his family property. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, yeah, I mean, the Miami Herald broke the story that Calvo, who has lived for years in a home that was receiving a low-income senior property tax exemption because, you know, his parents lived there. And at the same time, he was making $44,000 a year, you know, getting, you know, all while living in a house that got a tax break that was meant for abuelitas living on Social Security. Somebody got an anonymous, the property appraiser's office got an anonymous tip about it. And the Calvo family did have to pay more than $5,000 in back taxes and penalties. So there was that. But that's seen as less, I guess, of a sin as the other scandal that broke during the campaign, which was that the sitting mayor had apparently made changes to her home, additions to her home, without any permits. And that's still, I think, being investigated. She's got some code compliance issues. I think that people are more forgiving, I think, of a homestead exemption. You know, his parents did live in the home. He lived with his parents. Than they are about, you know, a sitting mayor, or she was actually a council person at the time, you know, making changes to the home, not getting the permits that, you know, other people in the city have had to wait months for and pay certain amounts for. So I think that hurt her more than it hurt him.
Right. For sure. I'd like to go now to Calvo's platform now, no longer as a candidate, but now as the mayor. So I want to go now to Calvo after his election night win, speaking about his priorities going into his mayoral term.
The elimination of property taxes for people over 65 in our city. Second, on water. We have water quality issues. We have residents in our city that the water's coming out yellow. We have residents in our city who are paying some of the highest rates of water in all Miami-Dade County. We need to eliminate the pensions in our city for public officials. There's no place for it.
So this kind of hits on a lot of the things that I was hearing from voters on election day in Hialeah, speaking about affordability. Like you mentioned, Hialeah is a working class community, a lot of abuelitos, a lot of older people, people with disabilities, and they're worried about the cost of living. How do you see that affecting the campaign, but also moving forward into the new year with a new council and a new mayor? What do voters want to see from their elected officials?
Well, you know, it's very interesting because, you know, I'm sure that you know that Hialeah has one of the highest ACA enrollment rates in the country.
We should say the Affordable Care Act. Yeah.
The Affordable Care Act. That's not a fluke. People there depend on it. And, you know, at a time when that's being threatened at a national level and at the state level, you know, Calvo could make a real difference if he partners with nonprofits, clinics, private providers, to make sure that residents know their options and don't lose coverage. That's one thing. SNAP benefits is something else that he, you know, but let's be real, okay? Brian Calvo is a Republican, and it's gonna be hard for him to, you know, be on top of those types of issues and continue to support his base or play to his base. The other thing is that, you know, while he ran on the water quality and also the pensions, he wants to rescind the pensions that Esteban Bobo gave himself and the council members at the last minute. Lately, he's also been talking about an anti-communist task force. Did you pick up on this? The former mayoral candidate, Alex Otaola, who has a website and a podcast and now also has a nonprofit organization that I'm not sure really is a nonprofit organization, I have to investigate. He helped him a lot with the campaign. And so now the mayor-elect, Calvo, has announced that he's gonna create a task force to investigate money laundering by communist businesses in Hialeah. It sounds very McCarthy to me and not what he campaigned on at all. So I'm a little concerned that might take over his platform. Because in the city of Hialeah, you know, that communism thing plays real well. So I don't know. It's still, we still have to give him a chance, obviously. Yeah. He can make city services more accessible. He certainly can make better online tools, help seniors, you know, be able to reach out easier.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm a little bit suspicious about whether or not he's going to really do that.
And in just a few seconds, as succinctly as we can, zooming out further, do you sense that there's a shift in Miami-Dade politics? I mean, there was a lot of really big surprises, including Cowboys' victory. As a political watchdog, do you feel like something changing?
Sure. Joe Carollo resigned. I mean, he's out. He's out. He says he's not going to be in politics anymore. It feels like we're watching a slow motion generational shift, I think. Miami voters are still pragmatic. They want competency. They want honesty more now than ideology. I think the Carollo defeat shows that people are tired of drama. The Calvo win shows that they're open to fresh faces and new ideas. There's an undercurrent across the board that voters are just tired of being treated like props in someone else's power play.
Thank you so much, Elaine. We've been speaking with Elaine DeValle of Politico Cortadito. Thank you so much for coming on. Still to come on the South Florida Roundup, more elections on the beach and in the Keys. Voters are desperate to get a hold on development. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Joshua Ceballos. To round out our 2025 election show, we are taking a flyover look at the results in four other cities in our region: Miami Beach, Homestead, Surfside, and the city of Marathon in the Keys. So to help us run down these results, I spoke with Jesse Schechner, reporter for FloridaPolitics.com. Jesse has covered South Florida politics for years and was following each of these races on election night. Hey there, Jesse. Thanks so much for speaking with us. I know you're pretty busy these days.
Yeah, well, thank you for making the time.
Starting right off the bat, let's talk about Miami Beach. The big race was for city mayor. The incumbent, Stephen Miner, faced off against his colleague, Commissioner Kristen Rosen Gonzalez, and won. He secured his reelection. Here's a clip of what Miner said after he got news of his win.
We saw the work that we did the last 2 years. We cleaned up spring break. We reduced crime. Almost 20%. Our homeless count is almost one of the lowest. We're opening new parks. We're doing infrastructure. And you know what? I never said a negative word in this entire campaign.
So both Miner and Rosen Gonzalez ran a campaign about being tough on crime, you know, securing the safety of Miami Beach, as we kind of heard in that clip there. Miner did, and so did Rosen Gonzalez. So can you break down how the two campaigns sort of differed? How did Rosen Gonzalez's campaign differ from Miner's? And what do you think brought Miner out on top?
Yeah, Rosen Gonzalez led in funding, but I think she struggled in messaging. Her and Miner's positions overlapped in several areas, including historic preservation and Miami Beach's homelessness ordinance. While Rosen Gonzalez touched on public safety, she focused more on balance issues, investments in parks and schools, supporting small businesses, climate resiliency, and so-called smart growth development that takes an existing local character into account. Miner, on the other hand, repeatedly hammered on his number one issue as being law and order, from crime reduction and more police visibility to less chaos during spring break and fewer unhoused people on the street. And it worked. Despite a few scandals and controversies that hit Miner in the past 2 years, like the O Cinema debacle over the showing of the No Other Land film and accusations of sexual harassment from his former SEC co-workers, he still prevailed. The Miner won by 51% of the vote, which still was not a large margin. It was 357 votes altogether.
Pretty close. And I'm glad you touched on those controversies. In the past few years of Miner's time in office, we've seen Miami Beach really crack down on crime, a lot more police presence. And I've spoken to a few residents who say, yeah, there's police everywhere. They're looking out for homeless people. They're closing down parks. And the spring break, obviously, Miami Beach had that big campaign of breaking up with spring break that kind of got attention nationally. What, in your estimation, does another term of Stephen Miner look like on Miami Beach? What do you sort of foresee happening with him still in office?
I see him continuing to focus on crime reduction, with short-term issues, at least one likely being the resolution of a possible conflict between the state and city's homelessness policies. Miami Beach passed its public camping ordinance, that's the homelessness thing, 1 year before the state passed its own comprehensive rules on the issue. State Representative Fabian Bisabe has made this a big issue. He's warned the city. He contends that Miami Beach is out of compliance with the state law in several ways and says it needs to amend its policies to come into compliance. Doing so would require a few minor adjustments. So it'll be interesting to see whether Miami Beach acquiesces or pushes back. I don't see Minor chasing down culture war issues like he did previously, at least not so overtly. The O Cinema thing drew national attention to the city, very little of it good. And while he viewed it as a public safety in matter of, you know, against anti-Semitism, no public safety issue actually stemmed from the movie screenings. And, you know, America's right to free speech exists to protect people and organizations from being muzzled by the government.
Yeah, absolutely. And there were also a number of other city commission races going on, a few city commission seats up for grabs on the beach. Did any of those races get decided outright on Tuesday night, or any of them going to a runoff?
Just one runoff. Three seats were at stake. And in the two races where sitting commissioners were defending their seats, both incumbents won big. Laura Dominguez kept her Group 2 seat with 61% of the vote over property investor Fred Carlton, despite attacks from her colleague on the dais, David Suarez, and Fabian Bisabe over her votes favoring and receiving donations from developers with interests in the city. In Group 3, Commissioner Alex Fernandez won by a whopping 84% over former Miami Beach Black Affairs Advisory Committee member Luigi Mary. That margin of victory, by the way, is, according to Fernandez's office, the most ever in a city commission race. I contacted the city clerk's office to confirm that, and I'm waiting for a response. In the race for the Group 1 seat, which Rosen Gonzalez vacated to run for mayor, a field of six candidates narrowed to two, just barely. Monica Mateo Salinas, a Miami Beach City employee, punched her ticket to the December 9th runoff with 23% of the vote. So did lawyer Monique Pardo Pope, who edged out real estate investor Brian Ehrlich by 119 votes.
Now, heading a little bit north on the barrier island, I want to shift our attention to the town of Surfside that had its own municipal election. But this one, there were no candidates on the ballot. This was mainly a referendum vote. So Jesse, would you mind running down for us the referendums in this year's Surfside election and how those votes shook out?
Sure. There were four questions on the ballot. The first, which failed, would have approved another $80 million to be spent on burying overhead electrical and communication lines. The second, which also failed, was a non-binding question, a straw poll, asking residents if they'd support creating a gated community in Surfside. Referendums 3 and 4 both passed. One amended the town charter to require a unanimous vote by the commission before spending more than $2 million on any single project, with that dollar amount rising over time with inflation. The other passed with 64% support, the most of any, and will now require 60% voter support before Surfside can spend 20% or more of its yearly property tax revenue on any single expenditure or investment.
Yeah, Surfside, famously, there's very little space there, and there's a lot of eyes on it for more development, even after the Champlain Towers collapse. Those votes sort of make sense. You know, the voters want to rein in the city government when it comes to building, if I'm not mistaken. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Joshua Ceballos. I'm speaking with FloridaPolitics.com's reporter for South Florida, Jesse Schechner, about the results of this week's elections in Miami Beach, Homestead, Surfside, and the city of Marathon. Shifting south, I want to move to the city of Homestead. So this city in southern Miami-Dade County has sort of been the epicenter of a lot of development in recent years, not unlike a lot of the rest of the county, but Homestead especially, as the rest of the county prices go up and people are being priced out of their homes, it's almost a common refrain for people to say that they're moving down to Homestead to find cheaper pastures. And that's become a flashpoint for the community, especially in these campaigns about overdevelopment. It's that prompted a whole slate of candidates to run on pumping the brakes on building and overdevelopment in Homestead. We saw this in the vice mayor race as well as in the two city council races. So, Jesse, did Homestead City Hall change much in this election?
It changed a bit. Incumbent council member Tom Davis lost his reelection bid by about 12 points to fellow Republican Kim Konski, who ran on an anti-traffic congestion, pro-development tax platform. David actually lost twofold. He was also running for the dual role of vice mayor and fell short there too against Councilwoman Jennifer Bailey. That was good in terms of simplifying things for the council, which would have had to appoint Bailey or another person as vice mayor anyway, since Davis lost his seat. And in the other race for the council's fifth seat, incumbent Erica Avila won re-election with 58% of the vote over challenger Sonia Castro.
And Homestead had a number of referendums on the ballot as well, which seems to be a trend in this election. There's a lot of referenda from all of the cities. So in Homestead, a few of them had to do with municipal bonds for roads and parks construction. How did Homestead voters respond to these ballot questions?
Two referendums passed, two failed. Homestead voters approved requiring runoff races for special elections to fill vacant council seats for 1 year or more. That replaced a prior arrangement where the biggest vote getters won outright, even if they didn't get more than 50% of the vote in a special election race. Now the two candidates with the highest votes below a majority will compete in a runoff. Voters also okayed a $39.6 million bond issue to pay for road construction repaid through property taxes, but they rejected extending consecutive term limits for the city mayor from 8 to 12 years, a move that would have aligned terms with those of city council members, and proposed a $36.4 million bond issue to pay for park improvements.
To summarize, they said yes to a bond for road improvements, but no to a bond for park improvements.
Yes.
Finally, moving down to our neighbors in the Keys, the city of Marathon had a city council election as well. Marathon, they do their elections a little differently from what I was seeing on the Supervisor of Elections website. It was an at-large election, and everyone was campaigning at once for three seats rather than, like in other cities, there's a group one, group two, group three. It's like everyone at once, and the top vote getters get the seats. Is that right, Jesse? Am I reading that correctly?
Yes, every voter had three votes, one for each seat on the ballot.
Gotcha. And how did that shake out for this small Keys community of about 10,000 people?
Two incumbents, G. Lynn Landry and Robin Still, won re-election with 17% and 16% of the vote, respectively. Landry currently serves as mayor, too, a largely ceremonial role given to him by his council peers. The third incumbent, Jeff Smith, lost his seat to challenger Deborah Strife, who took the most votes of all seven candidates on the ballot. Smith, who serves as vice mayor, also a ceremonial and council-appointed post, placed fifth overall. The winners each secured three-year terms.
Strife winning the most votes overall. What was her campaign like? What sort of motivated voters do you think from how she campaigned in this election?
She ran friendly to a degree on development, but not super friendly to it. She, you know, the responsible development sort of line, smart development. She also wasn't entirely against vacation rentals, but again, not too disruptive. I think that's sort of the idea. Progress is coming, but let's not say yes to everything. But she also kind of just talked about being a policymaker of the people, which sounds simple and trite, but it's something that always does well with the electorate.
And it seems to be doing well this election cycle. Thank you so much. Jesse Schechner is a reporter for FloridaPolitics.com who covers South Florida. Jesse, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Finally on the roundup, this week, an endangered loggerhead sea turtle was released into the Atlantic Ocean after a two-month-long recovery from a boat strike. Her name is Swim Shady. The adult female turtle returned to the wild behind the Loggerhead Marine Life Center in Juneau Beach. Jamie Pescatore is a vet tech at the Marine Life Center. She says Swim Shady was lucky to survive, as boat strikes can be fatal in most cases.
It's about to be mating season, so we did want to get her out so that she could partake in mating and kind of be able to lay nest as well. So definitely timing her rehab so she could get out in time.
Swim Shady was rescued in August. Her evaluation showed that she was carrying eggs and had limited vision in one eye, and she was anemic. The turtle underwent surgery to remove a loose piece from the upper part of her shell and recovered with antibiotics and supportive care. Her recovery was sponsored by a travel gear company, which held a contest to select her wonderful name. Now that'll do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. This show was produced by Jimena Romero with assistance from Denise Royal. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Matthias Sanchez is digital director. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news. The vice president of radio and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. MJ Smith engineered today's show. I'm Joshua Ceballos. Have a beautiful weekend, and thank you so much for listening. WLRN.